under the law because they want to live under the law, or do they live under the law? Does God think they live under the law?
I actually can't speak for God because we are not relatives. No. No, 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 we are not. He's not my uncle, so I cannot even defend him. But that they but that they live under the law, it is part of the Jewish life. If you take the law out, you have destroyed almost 50% of Judaism. You cannot actually be a Jew and break the law. You can't. How does God look at them? Well, I suppose we shall know on the last day of judgment. What is troubling you?
Well, since the Jewish people are the chosen people, and Jesus came as a Jew, and he did away with the law, then I would expect, God would expect them not to be under the law. Does that make sense?
Well, you see, the way that it happened in history is that some accepted Christ, some did not. Those, you know, all the apostles were Jews. One of them, I call him the bulldozer.
Bulldozer.
You know who is that?
Peter.
No, Paul.
Paul?
Poor old Peter. He can hardly write anything. No. Bulldozer, you know that big machine that created here in your country that can go in, it can destroy East 91st Christian Church in 5 minutes. You know, they are all Jewish people. What Christ did is he tried to open the boundaries, allow Gentiles to get into the blessing of Abraham, and to shift the emphasis. Because, you know, I had to spend the whole afternoon talking to someone, and sometimes, you know, when things are very hard in a debate, because Christians lived in a Christian environment, Christian education, Christian family, Christian everything, are not aware of what the law can do to us.
Now, if you imagine a square, you know, has 4 points. It's going to drive A from here. No, A is here. That's D. I better leave that to Bob Walter. But nevertheless, you know, the first thing here is that is where life is defined by the law. The first thing is that if you are here, the first corner of that square is that you became very much concerned with yourself, more than you are concerned with God. Here's my cannot deprive of you of your job. At least you can read your handwriting.
You know, you are always looking at yourself to know if you are right or wrong. So under the law, you are very busy with yourself more than you are very busy with God. And the second corner, sorry, I'll wait for you.
I got it.
Myself.
With myself, yes.
I mean, yes, okay. You're busy and I'm busy, so we're ourselves, but as we look at this from a theological standpoint, let's focus on me, which is our myself. Okay?
Okay. And the second part of the square, you are concerned with the reward. Yeah. The reward. If you do this, you are compensated or rewarded by whatever. And the third one, C, you are also frightened of the punishment. If you break the law, you are afraid of the punishment. What do you think is number four will be? This is the most nasty part of it. And I kept pressing the lady and her husband who came to speak to me. And this, you know, I said, you are very polite American Christians. Can you be nasty for a change? I said, no, we can't. It's not in our nature. What do you think number four will be? If you are busy with yourself, if you are busy with yourself, looking for the reward, afraid of the punishment, what do you think that will be? No, judgment is already there.
Keeping other people out?
Nah, you see, he's nice too. Can he become nasty, Aaron, for a change? Nasty.
No,
you can actually, you become blind. You cannot tell the difference between good and evil. Because what is blocking the understanding is that what is the difference between good and evil? You do good not because it is good, because there is a reward. You avoid evil because not because it is evil, but because there is a punishment. So actually, when you reach number D, you actually don't know anything about God. You know, that is, you know, what do you call it, whirlwind, you know? You know that thing that goes around, you know? Okay, you know, I think, you know, people like you, you know, so nice. I look at your beautiful eyes and what's left of your hair. You know. It's still there, don't worry. You know, and I keep saying, what a lovely people. I wonder what do they know about what the law can do. That's what the law can do. And you can live in that square for all the years of your life, be quite happy. Because I don't want to open that again, but because within that square, you have all your social relationship with the people who are like you, the community. You know, identified with the way you are dressed, the way you wash your hands, the way you pray, the kind of food you eat. I ate pork with Father Joseph this afternoon. So you can stop from kissing me for a week. So,
I'm the one who eats.
Well, now I became a Christian like you may. So, and you see, this is part, you know, what creates the identity. It is the desire to belong to something. Isn't that true, the belonging? I want to belong to. That's why I said to Aaron, you know, Aaron is one of my best friends. We meet sometimes on a Friday, but we never eat pork together. But one day, I want to take to that nasty place, you know.
I used to live in that part of the country.
Were you really? Oh, dear.
Yeah,
that's nice. He's nice. But, you know, this sharpness of rejecting the others, very sharp rejection. You don't eat what I eat. You don't dress in the same way I'm dressed. You don't go to the same place. Therefore, you are out my life. And you know, that takes place in politics also. Because, you know, sometimes politics are understood in religious terms. One of the books that I hope one day you will read is written by a Russian philosopher by the name Nicholas Berdyaev, called The Spirit of Russian Communism. And in that book, you will see clearly how communism took over the spirit of Orthodox Christianity. And they kept the relics of Lenin, they made icons of Stalin, they composed liturgies for the party. Oh, yes. And you know, because truly, if you really want to create a political ideology that gets into the mind and the heart of human beings, you have to use some religious ideas. political, but there is some ideas. That's why I think some of your political parts are not doing very good business, because there's not very much religion in them, I think. But I may be wrong. I'm not an American, so if I say something that is wrong about your country, I would beg you to forgive me.
It's your country now.
It's not my country. I'm British. So, it will be my country because I have many friends here more than ever. So, my dear brothers and sisters, today we need to look at justification by faith. And the handout, I'm glad, Mr. Walter, you managed to squeeze it to make it 10 pages, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Now, there was a whole thing about, there was a Jewish parable, some rabbi stuff that isn't in here, so we need to insert that. We can stick it in another time.
I'm sorry, I always do, you know, the way I hug you when I open my arms and hug all of you, that's what I do with any topic here. And then I start to squeeze it, you know. So something that you can really manage, read, and not to be overwhelmed by the information that at any rate. Two warnings before we get into the handouts. And please take that seriously. We are not here to pass judgment on people, whoever that may be. You know the old story of the four blind men who were given a chance to put their hands on the elephant? You know the story? And if you don't, I'll repeat the story in my own way. And the first one said, put his hand on the tail. And said, the elephant is very small and very slim, you know, it's a tail. And the next one put his hand on the side of the, said, it's like a wall. And one got hold of the leg, said, it's like a trunk of a tree. And one get hold of the trunk of the elephant. It's just an animal that has a big hose, you know. But in fact, all the four has given a fragment of what they feel. If they can see the elephant, they will change their mind. Sometimes I'm afraid theology and doctrines are like that. Many doctrines are slice of truth. They are not the whole truth. You know why? Because the whole truth is Christ, God's Son incarnate. That's the truth. And you know, you put your hand on Christ and feel something. Yep, what you have absorbed or observed is correct. But it is a fragment. And that's why I feel I don't like to fight over doctrines. I like to ask people, if you believe in that, what will happen to you? That would be my next point. How much of your faith will make your relationship with God advance? You know, when I was talking to the Muslims in under the dome of the University of Cambridge, I must have been asked, if I say 1,000 times, I will not be mistaken. What do you think of Islam? I say Islam is good. It's good. It tells you to do good, avoid evil. But what's the impact of Islam on your life? Because to do good and to avoid evil is not enough to make you creative, good human being. You need to be more than that. So what's wrong? I say, we're not talking about right and wrong. We're talking about someone who likes to go to work on a bike. Fine. Though on a day like this, I think you can't actually use a bike. But someone would like to go in a Rolls Royce. Or what's the most expensive car in the States?
Hummer.
Hmm? Troublemaker. No, not the hammer. No, no, it can't be. What's
Cadillac? Just call it Cadillac.
All right.
Jaguar.
A Jaguar. Okay. And someone would like to go in an airplane. And someone will does not have any money to do anything. He will walk. So, again, you know, when you have a means, what is the goal? You have a means. What is the goal? The goal is what? Yeah, to go to work. But, you know, so what is the means in Islam and what is the goal in Islam? What is the means in Christianity? What is the goal in Christianity? And I said to him, but in Christianity, the means and the goal is one. And that's Christ. He is the means and he is the goal. And that is the most important, unique element in Christianity. Because you see, you have to be somehow polite and nice in the university to students who paid so much money, part of it will come to my salary. And partly because you have to be also nice. And you have to be kind also. There's no need for, you know, a punch in the nose. A bloody nose, as we say, does not produce a good student. It will produce a fighter, someone that can fight you. So tonight when we talk about justification by faith, and next week and the week after, we are not saying who is right and who is wrong. But we're saying, if you cruise, travel in that direction, where do you think you will end? Are you with me? Where do you think that will lead you to? You know that square here? Sometimes we like even to make it for ourselves. By selecting a fundamentalist vision of Christianity. I know people who left East 91st and went to the most fundamentalist churches. They were very unhappy with the freedom we have here. Oh, yes. Some people didn't like the worship. That's fine. You see, all I'm saying is this. There's a difference between having Christ as a way of life, truth, freedom, love, hope, and the way of having him as a protection. If you hide in Christ to protect yourself from other Christians or other churches or other denominations, I don't believe you are going to make any progress. Becomes always a self-defense. And you know, self-defense is good if you are attacked, but suppose you are not attacked, you just are afraid of the other people. I remember once reading a story a long time ago of a man walking in the woods, and he was utterly frightened of bears, you know? You know bears? This, you know, good animals, you know? But fears. And while he was walking, it was a little bit dark, he saw something white, you know, in the dusk, you know, and he kept saying, that's a bear. So he managed to climb a tree, though I think a bear can climb a tree too, and sat there shivering all night from the cold and the fear, and in the morning discovered that this white was a tail of a rabbit. Tail of a rabbit. It wasn't in anything that will frighten him. Doctrines should not become a matter of fear. People come and knock on our door sometimes, and my best friend Jehovah Witnesses, you know. Sometimes I'm fierce, sometimes I'm nice, and sometimes I just say to them, you know, okay, there's no Christ, there's no eternal life, and everything we have in the church is wrong. Where does your teaching lead you to? What is the end? Okay, fine, we are wrong, you are right, fine. So, but the end, you know, what do you think this road will take you to? And sometimes you don't get a good answer. Because actually they never ask themselves, if I believe in this, what is the impact of that belief on my own individual or inner life? They don't. And once you touch the inner life, people started to listen sometimes, if they are adult enough, adult mentally. because it is possible for have someone to be 60 or 50 years old, but he has a mind of 10 years old or 15 years old. You know, what is the impact of that on your life? And you know, my dear brothers and sisters, if God is a cause of fear and hell is what makes you believe in Christ, then you missed completely the good news, and that is the gospel. If you are a Christian because you're afraid of punishment, you remember that square here? You are in that square without knowing. You are locked into that fear. It doesn't mean you have to deny the existence of hell. No. People said to me very often in the university, you never speak about hell. I said, yes, because I'm not planning to go there. And I have not met anyone who has been there. Hell is there, but I have no desire to be there. Where Christ is, there is heaven. And I want to stay with Christ. Do you have a problem with that? But you are not teaching the full truth. What's full truth? There is hell. But you know, it's something to know and something to live. Not afraid of it. But I'm afraid to say, as a Christian, I ignore it completely. For a very simple reason. I'm not looking for reward and punishment. That is childish behavior. If you do your homework, I'll give you a piece of chocolate. Isn't that what we do to our children? And sometimes in the schools? No. I will do my work because I really want to master science. I want to know English. You know, I want to learn your American colloquial English, which is very hard, believe me, in order to avoid making a mistake. Not because I'm afraid of criticism. It doesn't matter, whatever I will say, someone will always point that there's something wrong. That's fine. That doesn't disturb me. But you see, fear of punishment does not bring a disciple of Jesus. And you know, don't sit tight and think that the Lord will treat you according to your knowledge. No. No treatment according to the knowledge. That's not in Christianity. That's not in Judaism either. That's a heresy in the early church called Gnosticism. The Gnostics. Can you please write the name Mr. Walter? Start with a G. G-N. Gnosticism. And you know, it's a salvation by knowledge. You are not saved because you know. You are saved because you believe. And sometimes you believe in certain things that are paradoxical, difficult to even explain, mystery. Isn't that what Paul said? We look in a mirror, in a mystery, right? And therefore, in and out, when you read something that is unagreeable to you, historically wrong, well, I'm rather pleased that I'm wrong. Because there, you know, we say, if I'm wrong, if you make a mistake, enjoy it. And if someone comes and corrects you, enjoy it even more. But you see, the simple fact is this. We have to struggle to discover. Discover Christ. Christ in himself, and the teachers, and the historical things that we inherited. Oh my goodness. Christianity is 1,900 years old. 2,000. All right, 2,000. I'm mistaken in 10 years. 2,000. 100 years. Okay, it is 300, or whatever. And you know, we have inherited a long chain of teachers. You know? Some of them, very bright. Some of them are dull. And you know, that's why when you look at the handout, you will see here On page 3, returning to Paul. Introduction to Luther. And I'm not going into a historical introduction because that is a matter of history. That, in fact, Luther discovered justification by faith. But don't forget, when? 16th century Middle Ages Roman Catholic Church. Terrible. I'm telling you, terrible. I remember once Linda Smith sitting at the end smiling, you know, we give her the title, our theologian, you know, brought to a seminar we used to have in Carmel, the Latin, was it Latin or German? German. The exact text of the indulgences. And there was a man there, Cardinal, that the indulgence is something you pay to get a relative or to shorten your time in purgatory. And this man, Tetzel, you know, the cardinal used to say, when you put your money in the box, as soon as it hit the box, you know, it makes a noise, some of your friends will be released from purgatory. You know, it's just like our modern coffee machines, you know. When you put a coin and press, you know, and I was once at Marian College and I was really dying for a drink. I put a quarter and I pressed the machine, didn't get anything. It says 25 cents. And then I stood there, I said, is there an axe here? And then one of the girls came and said to me, what's the matter? I said, I put 25 quarter and I needed a drink. And, oh, that does happen. And she kicked it. And the bottle came through. I said, you know, this is, Marian College, you know, is a Roman Catholic college. I said, this is just like what Tetzel used to say in the Middle Ages, you know. But you see, in that atmosphere of the 16th century, he read Paul, and he was a man highly educated, and was troubled about the forgiveness of sins. And looked at the works that the people were demanding in the church. I am telling you something, I thought that it belongs to the Middle Ages. If you ever go to Rome, there is a big church called Maria Maggiore. Anybody been to Rome? Have you been to Maria Maggiore? Have you seen that marble door? That they open that marble door once every 50 years. Called the Jubilee Year. And whoever gets through that will be 500 years out of purgatory. Oh, if the Pope come with a hammer and break the door, and then people will get through. There was, and I saw it in the Vatican Museum, it has been actually removed by John Paul the 23rd, steps which the Crusaders took from Jerusalem, you know, these crafty old Arabs. They sold the Crusaders all sorts of weird things. They wanted the money and the gold. They said to them, you know, this is the steps which was led to the palace of Pilate. Jesus stood on these steps. They took all of it to Europe. It landed in Rome somehow. And there was in the Middle Ages, if you actually on your knees climb, I think it was 50 steps, if I'm not mistaken, then you get 50 years for every time you move on one step out of purgatory. Well, my dear brothers and sisters, Luther sat as a priest listening to confessions. That was the, as we say, this is, by the way, this is Arabic, this is not English because we don't have camels here. The last straw that what?
Broke the camel's back.
That broke Luther's back, actually. He sat listening to confession. And when he told people to repent, they said, we don't need to repent. We paid money not to go to purgatory. So we do whatever we like, and we pay our due to the church, and we are released. So he was on fire. Rightly so. That is the historical background. So when he read Paul, oh yes, I called Paul early the what? the bulldozer. When he read Paul, the righteous shall live by faith, and read Romans and Galatians, and read the Old Testament. The man translated the Bible into German, so he knew the scriptures. He kept saying, that cannot be correct. That is wrong. And then said, no, we are justified by faith alone, not by the works of the law, and therefore, let us get out of the Roman Catholic Church. And he did. That's very short, barbaric introduction to one of the causes of the Reformation, a man who looked into the life of the church and realized that it is certainly deviating, leading people away from Christ, from true repentance, from Christian life. So, what happened here is that people believed that justification by faith is certainly an important part of the Christian faith. And then, you know, in the Council of Trent, which is the council that the Catholic Church called, we'll get two or three lines on it over the next handout. Protestants and Catholics debated, you know, on page 2. First line, Aaron.
Yes.
Come and sit here. Leave Pat alone. She wants to write her notes. Oh, you want to write as well?
Yeah. Well, I can write and listen, or whatever.
It's an order.
Yes, sir. Started from New Testament?
No. Whether.
Whether the verb justify meant to make righteous Catholic or reckon as righteous Protestant. B. Mm-hmm. Whether justified denoted transformation or status. And C. Whether the righteousness of God was subjective genitive, righteousness as a property or an activity of God, or objective genitive, righteousness as a gift bestowed by God.
That's the debate that has been going on for 400 years.
Words.
you said it all. So when you are confronted by that, by saying, you know, if you are justified, then you are in yourself righteous. Is it to make righteous or to be reckoned by God as righteous? Because if you are righteous, then it brings with it the moral quality. Because that was the breaking point between Luther and the Catholic Church, that he said, no, our moral quality is not part of justification by faith. Are you with me? Nice to see you.
I see you too.
I always look for your shining head, you know?
Great minds always think alike.
Oh, yes. I agree with you. So, my dear friends, you know, would that debate continue with you and me? My answer is no. Why? Because, you know, when Paul wrote, he was not concerned about the subjective genitive or the objective genitive. You know, this is the work of the great grammarians, you know. He wrote something to the Jews in Rome and to the Gentiles to bring them together under the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I beg you, and I really mean it, shall I stand up and kneel on the floor, put my hand on my head on the carpet to tell you that I'm really serious? When you go to the great chapter on justification, it is in Romans chapter 4, 3 and 4, but 4 is the main bulk. We did chapter 4, but I just want to remind you. Abraham was justified by faith because he did what? He did not do anything. He believed in God. And you know, Paul said his faith was reckoned to him as righteousness. So what is that righteousness? It is a big puzzle. And I am quoting here to you, before we go to Paul, on page 7. N.T. Wright appeals to the Old Testament. It's a very long reading, sir.
Okay. Start there or right?
No, no. N.T. Wright appeals to the Old Testament. Because you see, do not forget, this comes out of the Old Testament. We'll go back in a minute, but I want you to just get a glimpse of what's it all about. Yes, sir, go ahead.
First, who is N.T. Wright, George?
Oh, N.T. Wright is the Bishop of Durham, and he is a great defender of the Christian faith in the rundown country called Great Britain. I believe very much in what's the former Minister of Defense?
Tom Rumsfeld?
Yeah, Tom Rumsfeld, when he said, you know, the old Europe, he was right. This one thing that he should be right about, you know. It's run down, and he put a lot of good books on the market. I quoted the book here. You can see that on page 9. N.T. Wright, what St. Paul really said. Have you got it? Above the line on page 9. But I want you to just have a glimpse of the debate, because another man by the name John Piper, anybody here is a fan of John Piper? Put your hand up. What? There's no supper for you tonight, because you want to cook it. You know, John Piper wrote a book, Reply to N.T. Wright.
The Future of Justification,
yes,
is what it's called.
And I got it, I read it, you know. I became very depressed. You know why? Because either he did not understand the book, and that's possible, that because, you know, I don't like this guy, so whatever he says, I take an offense, just because I don't like him. You know, when I was in England and I decided to come to USA, my very English friend said to me, "You're going to live in the USA for the rest of your life?" I said, "Yes, what's wrong?" They have better burgers to start with. And there's a woman there whom I love waiting for me. And they said, "You're going to regret it." I said, "No. I have been there before." "Really?" I said, "Yes. And I like Carmel. I like the people I met there. Nice people." And you know, Americans, when they stand at an X-ray machine, you can see their bones and their flesh. It really looks human. And that gives me hope. They are human beings like you, like me. They get depressed, they get joyful, they make a blunder in politics, just like your prime minister, like everybody else, you know, human beings. Well, you're whatever, you know.
Just pick one.
You're right. Listen, I need to go home, you know, so you can guess. And, you know, they are human beings, you know, they are human beings. I saw the churches and I... So the woman I want to marry, and that's it. You know, it's a nice place. And however, if I'm content with the little I have, I will be content even with less. But here in England, you know, what's there in England, you know? I'm going. But because, you know, they don't like USA, they look back. America. And actually, we had a man from New Jersey. And they called him all the time the Yankee. And he came and said to me, "Why are they calling me the Yankee?" I said, "Because they don't like Americans. There's no need for you to be called the Yankee. Because the Yankee belongs to a particular period in the Civil War." Am I right in that?
Revolutionary War.
Okay, well, Revolutionary War, whatever war, you know. And you know, you are not the Yankee in any sense. And you know, just ignore them. And, you know, the people who called him a Yankee. On Christmas vacation he came, there must have been a sale. He brought tonight to England 32 pairs of jeans. How he managed to figure out the size of the professors in the faculty, That's beyond my imagination. And gave each one of them a gene, pair of genes, and they loved the Americans. That's a true story. Okay.
Okay, here we go. N.T. Wright appeals to the Old Testament. The righteousness of God has been quite drastically obscured in various translations, not least in the crucial passage of Romans 3:21 through 26 in the New International Version. For instance, Paul meant at least two quite different things by the phrase within the space of these six verses. For the reader of the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Jewish scriptures, the righteousness of God would have one obvious meaning: God's own faithfulness to his promises to the covenant. God's righteousness, especially in Isaiah 40 through 55, is that aspect of God's character because of which he saves Israel, despite Israel's perversity and lostness.
Please, put a line under that. Despite Israel's what?
Perversity.
And?
Lostness.
You know, God will not change his character because Israel has changed its character. Because if he does, he's no longer God. Okay, go on.
God has made promises. Israel can trust those promises. God's righteousness is thus cognate with his trustworthiness on the one hand and Israel's salvation on the other.
Because salvation is part of the bargain, you know, of the covenant, the treaty. I keep my bargain if you don't. That does not happen among us human beings. If you break your commitment, well, I'm free, I break my commitment, right? But not God. No. That is the backbone of the Bible in both testaments. You have been unfaithful, but I will remain faithful. That is the gospel. Okay.
At the heart of that picture in Isaiah stands, of course, the strange figure of the suffering servant through whom God's righteous purpose is finally accomplished. In the Septuagint, the phrase means, most naturally, God's faithfulness to his covenant with Israel, as a result of which he saves her from her exile in Babylon. There are a good many occurrences of the phrase, or close cognates in Second Temple Jewish literature. They all reinforce this basic reading. At the heart of God's righteousness is his covenant with Israel, the covenant through which will be addressed and solved the problem of evil in and for the whole world. Part of the particular flavor of the term, however, comes from the metaphor which it contains. Righteousness is a forensic term, that is, taken from the law court. This needs to be unpacked just a bit. The Hebrew law court. Judge, plaintiff, and defendant. One, in the biblical law court there are three parties, plaintiff and defendant. There is no director of public prosecutions, district attorney. All cases take the form of one party versus the other party, with the judge deciding the issue. Two, what does it mean to use the language of righteousness in this context? It means something quite different when applied to the judge to what it means when applied to either the plaintiff or the defendant.
Are you aware? Take notes of that. This is actually copied from N.T. Wright, word for word. I did not delete one single statement. Because I'm not going to wait for you to buy the book. You know? Okay.
Apply to the judge, it means, as is clear from the Old Testament, that the judge must try the case according to the law, that he must be impartial, that he must punish sin as it deserves, and that he must support and uphold those who are defenseless and who have no one but him to plead their case. For the judge to be righteous, to have practiced righteousness in this forensic setting, is therefore a complex matter to do with the way he handles the case.
Mm-hmm.
Three. For the plaintiff and the defendant, however, to be righteous has none of these connotations. They, after all, are not trying the case, nor, less obviously to us because of the moral overtones of the word righteous, now has in our own language.
You see, please pay attention to that. That when you talk about righteous, there is a moral
overtones
being downloaded on it. Okay.
Does the word mean that they are, before the case starts, morally upright or deserving to have the verdict go their way? No. For the plaintiff or the defendant to be righteous in the biblical sense, within the law court setting, is for them to have that status as a result of the decision of the court. How does this work out? Let us take the plaintiff first. If and when the court upholds the plaintiff's accusation, he or she is righteous. This doesn't necessarily mean that he or she is good, morally upright, or virtuous. It simply means that in this case, the law court, the court has vindicated him or her in the charge they have brought. It is the same with the defendant. If and when the court upholds the defendant, acquitting him or her of the charge, he or she is righteous. This, again, doesn't necessarily mean that he or she is good, morally upright, or virtuous. Simply that he or she has, in this case, been vindicated against the accuser. In other words, acquitted.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the word dikaios, righteous, in secular Greek as in English, carried moralistic overtones. Granted this, it is not hard to see how it could come to refer not just to a status held after a decision of the court, but also to the character and past behavior of either plaintiff or the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
But the key point is that, within the technical language of the law court, righteous means, for these two persons, the status they have when the court finds in their favor. Nothing more, nothing less.
Mm-hmm.
The result of all this should be obvious, but is enormously important for our understanding of Paul. If we use the language of the law court, it makes no sense whatever to say that the judge imputes, imparts, bequeaths, conveys, or otherwise transfers his righteousness to either the plaintiff or the defendant.
Uh-huh.
Righteousness is not an object, a substance, or a gas which can be passed across the courtroom. For the judge to be righteous does not mean that the court is found in his favor. For the plaintiff or defendant to be righteous does not mean that he or she has tried the case properly or impartially. To imagine the defendant somehow receiving the judge's righteousness is simply a category mistake. That's not how the language works.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
What happens, then, when we put the covenantal meaning of God's righteousness together with the metaphorical level drawn from the law court scene? God, of course, is the judge. Israel comes before him to plead her case against the wicked pagans who are oppressing her. She longs for her case to come to court, so for God to hear it, and in his own righteousness, to deliver her from her enemies. She longs, that is, to be justified, acquitted, vindicated. And because the God who is the judge is also her covenant God, she pleads with him, "Be faithful to your covenant. Vindicate me in your righteousness. Enter not into judgment with your servant, O God, for in your sight no man living be justified." That's Psalm 143, in fact, from which those words come, forms a typical statement of the Jewish hope, covenantal, shot through with metaphorical law court overtones. It also happens to be the psalm Paul quotes at a crucial turn in his argument, Romans 3:20. If and when God does act to vindicate his people will then, metaphorically speaking, have the status of righteousness. The righteousness they have will not be God's own righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
That makes no sense at all. God's own righteousness is his covenant faithfulness, because of which he will, Israel hopes, vindicate her and bestow upon her the status of righteous as the vindicated or acquitted defendant. But God's righteousness remains, so to speak, God's own property. It is the reason for his acting to vindicate his people. It is not the status he bestows upon them in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
in all this discussion, it is clear that we must add one further dimension to the discussion. If the covenant between God and Israel is the basic context of meaning within which righteousness language finds its home, and if the law court is the metaphorical context which gives particular color to the covenantal language, then both contexts demand that there be a future fulfillment, eschatology, the long hope of Israel for her God to act at last, once and for all, must be brought in at every point.
Thank you, sir. You can sit down. Thank you. I'm sorry for that long reading because, you know, he is a great writer and you must not miss one line. I could not summarize that for you. And I wanted to read it again, you know, because, you know, the whole issue in N.T. Wright and other people also, and, you know, is that, look here, if you stand facing God in the court of law in the biblical sense, not in the American sense or the English sense or any sense, you know, your best defendant is God and God's faithfulness. You know, he will disregard your moral quality completely. He will look at you as someone who accepted to be in covenant with him. That's the Old Testament background. When you come to the New Testament, the covenant will be not that of the old, but will be Christ himself. That's why after reading N.T. Wright and typing him, you know, I kept saying, there is still one mistake in N.T. Wright. And that one mistake is here on page 9. N.T. Wright, like many Western scholars, still work within this frame. Grammatical analysis of the texts, creating and defining concepts, building up a system that is based on both 1 and 2. That is what we call scholastic approach. But the problem...
Scholastic
approach. The problem is that the righteousness of God is not revealed as an attribute. It is part of an action. But this action is not just an action. It is the life and the death of the and the resurrection of the Son of God, of the righteous God. You see? We are not dealing with a concept. And you know, the major correction comes from Romans. Righteousness is not an abstract attribute of God. It is a revelation of divine benevolence towards Abraham. Isn't that what we read in chapter 4? And thus a personal relationship. In Romans 4:9, Abraham's faith was reckoned as righteous. As righteousness. And so it is his personal relationship. When Paul compares Adam and Christ in Romans chapter 5, Paul is not dealing with concepts, but with two persons, Adam and Christ. Now, I need two people to volunteer here. One to be Adam, one to be Christ. So it will be very clear. Who will volunteer? I need a man and a woman. Come on. Come on, hurry up. For it goes. It goes once, twice. Come on. Come on. Are you going to read for me?
Sure.
Come on. Come on, Denise. Come on. What do you like to be?
I think it's appropriate that I'm Adam.
You are Adam. And you want to be Christ?
Not really, but okay.
Okay.
I don't have a choice.
You have a choice. No, you don't have a choice. It's too late. Okay. Now, listen. When Paul speaks about Adam, this is actually word for word from Romans chapter 5. Go on. Number 1.
Sin came to the world and death through sin.
Mm-hmm.
Sin was in the world before the law. Death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like Adam.
Mm-hmm.
Judgment and condemnation. Death reigned through one man.
The last statement is absolutely important. Death reigned through one man. Okay? Christ.
Free gift, not like the trespass. Number 2, free gift of grace of that one man, Jesus, abounded for many. 3, the free gift is not like the one man's sin. 4, the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reigns in life through the one man, Jesus.
Again, you know, the reign of Adam in death and the reign of Jesus in grace and life. Righteousness. And then the conclusion.
Now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life?
Mm-hmm.
The abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reigns in life through the one man Jesus, Romans 5:17.
Mm-hmm. More important is what Paul himself says. Jesus Christ, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and sanctification and redemption in him. You know, we're dealing with a person, not with a concept. And I think if we, thank you. Thank you very much. You know, when we look back and say, here is Adam, and here is Christ, the damage that has been done there has been repaired here. And the damage is reigning. You know reigning? Reigning like a king. You know, sin reigns in death. And it came through one man. But now, life, grace, righteousness, salvation, because Christ himself is our righteousness. The one who brings us back into the status of the children of God. We are not dealing with a concept. That is utterly untrue. And I would like to remind you, always remember, if you can imagine, you know, sin sitting on a throne called death. That's reigning. Like a king, you know? And then Christ comes to destroy that throne called death. And therefore, Paul will say, now there is no condemnation on those who are in Christ Jesus. Why? Because the reign of death, which is the fruit of sin, has been abolished.
Amen.
Yes, sir. I saw a hand. Is that your hand?
I think I had a question, but I don't think I have a question.
You change your mind? Are you afraid of me?
No.
I'm your brother. We eat together.
Oh, yeah. Then does sin have authority because of death?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like when someone sits down, it's their sitting that gives them the authority.
Yes. Sin has authority. Thank you, Aaron. I call him Mr. Philosopher, but I don't think he's very happy with the title. You happy with the title?
No.
What shall I call you then?
Just Aaron.
Just Aaron? But that's no ordinary.
It's honoring to my parents. They gave me the name.
But I'm your parent, one of your parents too. I want to give you another name.
Call me whatever you want. Call me whatever you want.
Poor man. Listen.
We don't know
what is the authority of sin that dictates something in us?
Death.
It's the fear of death. You know,
fear of death.
The fear of mortality. We are afraid of death. All of us. I am afraid of this. All of us. There is not one single human being, including Jesus himself, who is not afraid of death. In the agony in the garden, he expressed that fear. Yes. But you see, fear of death is mortality, and mortality changes all our inner life. I want to possess more to secure my life. I want to have more money in the bank because that gives me sense of security. I cannot accept anyone to criticize me because I like to maintain the image of the perfect person. Right? And it goes on. It's a long train, you know. If you travel to England, you know, and you take one of the British trains, you know, it's a train, it's like the trains you see here in that carries the freight train here, you know. It's long, it takes about half hour. If you take a train from London to Edinburgh, it's about 22 or 30 or 40 carriages, you know. goes like a big snake, you know? And mortality is like that. Fear of death. You know, if someone scratch your face, I say to my wife, I'm not going to shave on this day because if I cut myself, that's a fear of mortality. Suppose I cut myself. So what? You think I'm ugly? I know that I'm ugly. What's new? You know? Oh, by the way, nobody called me cute again, which is rather unusual. You know, it's very strange, you know. So listen, my friends, it's fear. You know, if you stand in the mirror and discover, I was eating with Father Joseph and a little bit of spot came and he said, you have a spot here. Oh, what a catastrophe. Do you know? And he said, I'm not going to change. I keep it there to prove that I ate pork with you. You know, he didn't like my joke, actually. No. You should be presentable. I said, yes, I should be. But, you know, it is not fear of criticism. Fear of rejection. You know, have you seen Fiddler on the Roof? Yeah. Fiddler on the Roof. What was the complaint of the old girl in the film? I am so old. I remember, forgot the age. And nobody ever spoke to me. I'm nowhere is the matchmaker to get me a husband. I have been forgotten. Well, isn't that nice to be forgotten sometimes? Rather than to marry, what's the name? I forgot the man, the butcher, in the village.
Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Wolf? Yeah, yes, Mr. Wolf, yes. Oh, it's frightening. If I am a woman, I would commit suicide and not marry this man. you know, isn't that incredible, you know, this, and he, why he became so angry? How could you break your promise and give your daughter to the tailor? Isn't he was at the tailor? Mm-hmm. You know? And then, you know, the big fight at the wedding night. What stirred all that? Fear. And fear goes back to our mortality. My goodness. I had one of my colleagues, she was 35 years old, and she was walking very depressed out of the faculty. A great woman, great brain. Good afternoon, how are you? I said to me, it's not one of my best days. What happened? I burned the breakfast, and you know, I cook my breakfast, and I'm not married. I'm a single woman, and I don't share my life with anyone. I think I'm fading away, George. I said, no, you have life in your own self. Listen, I want to make a diagram. Still up to 3 minutes. I want to make a diagram of what is the catastrophe of the modern person. You are a humble man, Mr. Walter.
Not so.
You are. Cleaning that thing for me, that's
sure.
You're a wonder.
I don't think it's going to be very good. Maybe we have to do it.
Spit on it.
I don't know if that works or not. This makes it worse, I think.
No, never mind. Okay.
We
don't have time.
Okay, listen, my dear friends. Modern man is caught into the largest dilemma. The outer circle, you have the iPod, the laptop. What's the initial for laptop? LT. The cell phone, your mother-in-law. Your job, you know, this outer circle. People move in that outer circle to draw inner strings. The problem is this. You need also to have an inner circle. If there's no life here, none whatsoever, in the inner circle. So when you move out here, the more you move, the more you became empty. Because there is something in us that cannot be satisfied.